Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Sanjay Touré, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Sanjay.
Hello. I like the emphasis on my last name. You said it right.
Did I say it right?
Yep. Look.
I want to make sure I said it right. Last week, busy week?
Yeah, it was a really busy week at WeWork.
Why don't you tell our listeners what we were doing over there?
So we interviewed a bunch of business owners at WeWork, and it went amazingly well, my opinion.
It was what, 10, 15 business?
Yeah, it was really crazy. It was kind of like this, very chaotic, a lot of people in the room.
And a beautiful facility, right?
Yes, very nice facility. I like the coffee and espresso machines and the snacks everywhere. It was awesome.
It was a lot of fun, but it won't be as much fun as we're going to have here today.
Nope.
It's going to be a big show.
Yep.
We got a full house here today. We got the guests. We got paparazzi. I think there might even be food if we do a good job.
Right.
We'll see how that goes. So let's kick off the show with Kyle Wade. He is with Atlanta Community Food Bank. Welcome, Kyle.
Thank you, Lee. Good to be here.
Well, Kyle, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Atlanta Food Bank? How are you serving folks?
Sure. So the Atlanta Community Food Bank is one of the largest hunger relief organizations in the Southeast. We serve 29 counties in Metro Atlanta and North Georgia. And across those 29 counties, we support a network of close to 700 partner organizations who, working with us, distributed more than 61 million meals to 750,000 people last year.
Now, how did the food bank get started? How long has it been around?
The food bank was founded in 1979 in the basement of St. Luke's Church over on Peachtree Street, right in the middle of Atlanta. We were founded by a great civic leader, a guy named Bill Bowling, who many people in Atlanta know. And Bill, I think, had an inspiration that a number of other people around the country around the same time had, which is a lot more churches would be feeding people in need if they could access the food that they needed to do that work. And they needed a centralized place in the community to collect donations of food to support the decentralized distribution of that food. And so that basic insight in that year led to about 15,000 pounds of food being collected and donated out through the community. And as I said today, you know, we're a much bigger, different enterprise collecting more than 75 million pounds of food a year.
Now, are food banks in every city? Is that a common thing?
There are about 200 food banks that are across the United States, all part of the Feeding America Network. It's our national association that the member food banks created to help set common standards for ourselves. But we cover every county in the United States, including here in Georgia. There are about 8 different food banks that serve the state of Georgia, and every one of our 157 counties in Georgia is covered by one of those food banks.
Now, can you walk our listeners through what's the food bank like inside? Like, how does the logistics of this work?
Sure. So our food bank exists today in two facilities over off of Joseph E. Lowry Boulevard here in Atlanta, on the west side of Atlanta in town. And inside that facility, you know, we feel like a food distribution operation in a lot of ways. So we've got trucks coming in, delivering all sorts of products, fresh produce, meats and poultry items, dry goods. And we're handling that product, getting it into racks where it's stored. And then our partner agencies are placing orders online. We pick that product and turn it into orders that either get picked up at our facility or that get delivered on our trucks out to the community. We have about 20 trucks that are on the road every day. But in addition to that food distribution operation, we also are a community facility. So we have just hundreds of volunteers every week who are coming to the food bank to help us inspect, sort, and pack food into a variety of different food categories. We have community meetings at our facility all the time. We have a learning kitchen where we're teaching members of the community how to use food in a healthier way. And so it really is this unique blend of sort of hardcore food distribution operational business with a community footprint.
And then the community part, are volunteers coming in and they're doing sorting, or what are some of the responsibilities of the volunteers?
Yeah, so primarily on our campus, volunteers come and they will, in a big sort of assembly line fashion, help us inspect food and kind of disqualify some of the food that we can't redistribute. They sort it into different categories, mixed food, condiments, beverages, et cetera. And then we box that food up, the volunteers do, and it goes into our inventory. They also help us produce boxes that go to seniors through one of our programs. They help us sort produce, and they help us distribute food through our agency network, both on-site and off-site. So there are a variety of ways that volunteers support our work, and we're always looking to grow the number of people who are volunteering with us. You know, this time of year is particularly busy with our volunteer shifts. We have about 10 shifts a week that we staff, and they're all booked up through the end of the year. But there are ways for folks to go to our website, acfb.org, and you can sign up to participate in one of those shifts.
So you can participate as an individual, or my church group can participate, or my business can participate.
That's right.
There's lots of different ways to participate.
Yeah, and usually people do come in groups. I mean, people come as individuals too, but the vast majority come in groups, and it's a great team-building activity. We have companies that will do a volunteer shift, but they'll also schedule an off-site meeting and use our space for that meeting.
So they can do a business, they can do a business meeting,
yes,
in one portion of your facility.
That's
and then
right.
Actually do some of the volunteer work at a different time during that day.
Yes, and it's just it's a way for them to kind of bring their team together,
right,
and
get out of the office and into,
yep,
a new environment.
That's right.
So now you're mentioning all of this tons and tons of food that gets processed through your organization. I'm having a hard time visualizing all this. Is this individual people like going through their shelves, getting old cans of food and putting it in a bag? And sometimes you see that. Like, how is the food kind of come about? Is it grocery stores where you're getting it in mass? Are there restaurants? You know, how does that?
Well, so certainly individual donations of food are important. And, you know, my mom likes to give food to her local food pantry. And so she'll do the food drive thing and take it down and put some cans in a barrel. And that's a great way to engage the community. It represents a very small percentage of our total volume. The vast majority of food that we are collecting is coming from large companies or large enterprises. And so about 65% of the food we collect is donated, usually in truckload quantities from larger businesses, you know, distributors, manufacturers of food,
farmers. So food
farmers,
distributors, food companies.
Food companies, farmers. You know, we're pulling produce across the Southeast here to our facility, and it'll be a truckload of watermelons or a truckload,
right,
of sweet potatoes or what have you. And then there's also grocery stores. We service about 500 grocery stores where we're going to pick up primarily perishable food at the back of the grocery store and then getting it somewhere in the community that day to try to distribute it as quickly as possible.
So that's really a service to those stores, because what would they do with it if you weren't around to take it?
Well, what we found out early on is that it's one thing to go to a grocery store and say, hey, you should give us food because you ought to,
right,
and because it's the
right
thing,
thing
to do,
do,
versus, hey, you should give us food because we're going to help you solve a business problem. We're going to help you reduce your waste. We're going to help you reduce your waste hauling fees. We're going to help give you some insight into your inventory. All of that was part of the business proposition that allowed us to build relationships with a variety of food donors over the years. So private enterprise is a huge source of the donations that come to us. We also get about 25% of our volume from federal commodities, you know, a variety of federal programs for the government that donate food to us. And then we buy some of our food. We buy about 10% of our volume.
And then what the perishables, what's the challenge there to get them in and out as quickly as possible?
Yeah, so our business has changed pretty radically over the last decade. You know, in 2008, we were distributing about 15 million pounds of food, so significantly different volume than we are today, five times less than where we are today. And at the time, almost all of it was non-perishable stuff. You know, it was all dry goods, canned goods, box goods, et cetera. Today, at a much higher volume, more than 40% of what we distribute is either fresh or frozen. And our largest product category is fresh produce. Last year, we distributed close to 16 million pounds of fresh fruits and vegetables. And that shift has required us to make huge investments in our supply chain. So we needed more refrigerated trucking. Right. We needed bigger freezer cooler space. We needed to invest in the freezer cooler capacity of the 700 partners that get food from us and distribute it in the local community. It's okay for us to grow, but if they're not growing that same capacity, then they can't really handle the food that we're providing them. So, and it has now led us to start a capital campaign to build a whole new food bank with much greater freezer cooler capacity than we have today.
So now the you're not, or maybe you are, the food that you have, does it ever go to the end individual, or it always gets distributed through other agencies that are talking to the end and giving it to the end individual?
So we today primarily are just distributing food as the wholesaler. Mm-hmm. Right? We're distributing food to those 700 partners.
So the partners are then giving it to the hungry person.
Right. And the power of that is it gives us much greater leverage, right? So we've got 165 staff people at our location, and they're awesome. They're the best food bankers in the world, but there's only so much that 165 people can do, as opposed to 700 partners who all have their own volunteer groups and networks, their own donors, and who have a localized understanding of what need looks like in their neighborhood. And, you know, what you see in those 700 partners are just local community heroes is what I would call them, folks who have stood up and said, you know, not in my backyard, this is my neighborhood, these are my neighbors, mm-hmm. and we're going to ensure that every one of them has the food that they need.
And then they each have unique needs, and then you customize your solution to whatever their unique need
is. Yeah, well, they customize it themselves, right? So they're ordering inventory from us.
Right.
And so they're selecting from what we're offering to meet their needs. And we hear from them, you know, so, hey, you need more of this, you need more of that. And we're about trying to meet some of those needs of our agency partners.
So if they say they have a need, then you can go to the places you get the food and say, hey, we need more sweet potatoes.
Well, we can work on it. You know, some things are easier to work on than others.
Right.
But
like what's an example of someone had a need and then you were able to solve it?
So a great example would be JFCS, Jewish Family and Career Services, is a local organization serving people in need in the Jewish community in town, Atlanta. And they have a kosher pantry, mm-hmm. right? So a lot of the food that we get isn't necessarily kosher.
Right.
So we actually work with them to do a kosher food drive at one point and help provide more of the food that they need for their constituents. You know, a lot of our agencies are serving large populations of seniors, or they're serving large populations of particular cultural or ethnic groups. And the dietary requirements and preferences of those communities are reflected in the inventory they need. So, you know, we'll work with different partners to try to source more of that product.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the hungry in Georgia. Is this something that's just in every community, and it's not noticeable to a lot of the people? Like, can you tell us, like, kind of what this looks like?
Yeah, so I think what's interesting is a lot of people, when they think of the food bank, you know, sometimes they'll think of the food bank as being one of our food pantries partners, as opposed to kind of a big distribution organization.
Right, you're like a supply chain logistics company.
Right, and then similarly, when they think of the food bank in terms of the people we serve, they might think of the homeless population. Which is an important population. It's a group that we do serve, but it's a relatively small percentage of our overall client base. In Georgia, 1 in 7 people are food insecure, meaning they don't always know where their next meal is going to come from. They often run out of food. 1 in 7 people. 1 in 5 kids live in those food insecure households. And our prototypical client at the Atlanta Community Food Bank really is a single mom with a couple of kids earning less than $35,000 a year. That's our client, right? And there are hundreds of thousands of those people just within the 29 counties we serve who are working or trying to get back to work, and just their income does not meet their full needs. And so what they experience is at the end of the month, you know, 2, 3, 4 days in the month, they run out of resources and they need to turn to a food pantry to help get them across the finish line that month.
Mm-hmm.
Living with that stress and that ongoing insecurity in their food supply has all kind of consequences in their lives, health consequences, stress consequences. It leads them to incur higher medical bills, to have higher rates of disease that they have to deal with. It hurts their income and ultimately leads to trade-off decisions like, I'm going to buy food instead of buying medication. I'm going to buy food instead of paying my utility bill. I'm going to buy food instead of paying my rent or mortgage. And so that need for these low and moderate income working families is, even in this time of great economic prosperity, really significant, and it's not going away. So, you know, need is everywhere. It's kind of hidden. It's here in where we sit today in one of the most affluent parts of our state. I could take you over to Roswell Road in Upper Sandy Springs. There are apartment complexes up and down that road where there are just countless people who are dealing with this issue.
And then when these people, is the number getting bigger or littler? Are we making any headway?
I think there's good news in the sense that this is an economic problem more than it is a food supply problem.
So there's food is available. I mean,
there's more food available than we know what to do with, right? I mean, I think we overproduce food in our country, and everybody is aware of that. Getting the food to the people who need it is a logistics problem, but it's more than that. It's an economic problem so that people can afford their own food. And when the economy is as strong as it is right now, and it's very strong, you know, full employment, essentially, really strong GDP growth, et cetera, that does have a positive impact on the number of people who are in need of our support. So we're seeing some of that need decline over the last couple of years. But that said, there's still 820,000 people in our 29-county service area, including around 300,000 children who live in these vulnerable homes. And so the need is less than it was, but it is still unacceptably high.
Right. And then does it happen when the economy is going well that less people donate, or does that impact that side of the equation?
We have not had that experience recently at the Atlanta Community Food Bank. Certainly when times are good, in some ways it might take the spotlight off of an issue like hunger in terms of the public consciousness.
Right.
But it's also a time when people are, you know, the stock market until recently was really going great guns, and people are sitting on inflated
and they feel
portfolios.
More generous.
They feel a little more flush and a little more generous. So it's a mixed bag, you know, and I think our job is to continually find a way to articulate the problem that we're solving for food insecurity, the urgency of that problem. There's still 300,000 children who don't always have the food that they need, and that affects how they do in school and in life. And it's our job to say that we're going to be a great steward of your financial investment in us. So the Atlanta Community Food Bank has earned a 4-star rating from Charity Navigator, I believe, for 7 years in a row. And we're only 3% of the charities in the United States evaluated by Charity Navigator have earned a 4-star rating, its highest rating, for 7 consecutive years. For every dollar someone donates to us, it helps us provide up to 4 meals to the community. So we're a great investment, solving a really important problem in ways that we think are urgent and impactful.
Now, do you have any initiatives going into the holiday season?
We sure do. So the main one to make your listeners aware of is, you know, Giving Tuesday is coming up. It's the, you know, we have Black Friday, we've got Cyber Monday. We've got,
why not Giving Tuesday?
We got Giving Tuesday.
Absolutely.
And it's the best of them all.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And so on Giving Tuesday for the Atlanta Community Food Bank, when you donate to us, it doubles your investment because we've got a great partner company, Medlytics, that Arvind and Tony and the guys up there do great work, and I can't even explain their business, but Medlytics, go learn about it. And they do awesome work, and they're great supporters of the food bank. They're matching every dollar donated up to, I think, $50,000 to the Atlanta Community Food Bank on Giving Tuesday. So when you give a dollar on Giving Tuesday,
that's like giving $2.
It's like giving $2. So instead of helping us provide four meals, you're helping us provide eight meals. And it's a great way to participate. Beyond that, you know, we're hard at work throughout the season trying to generate resources to support our mission. But we've also started a capital campaign to build a new facility and to dramatically expand our programming so that we can ensure everybody has enough food.
And then there's lots of ways to help. Obviously, money is one way. There's volunteer time, right? There's you need volunteers throughout the year, not just in holiday seasons, right?
Without question. And, you know, again, you can go to our website, acfb.org, to learn how you can engage as a volunteer. And that's certainly with us. You know, we encourage people not only to volunteer at the food bank, but to connect with one of those 700 partner organizations in your local neighborhood where you can volunteer there as well.
Is that on the website as well, some of the partner agencies?
Yeah, you can find a local an agency.
In your community.
In your community. You can find ways to get involved in advocacy. I think a lot of people, we just had an election, people are energized and activated around the public policy environment. And there are a lot of ways to get involved there as well. You know, so there are endless opportunities for folks to make a difference with the food bank and certainly with other community groups. We encourage you just to kind of take the first step, go to our website and find out how you can get involved.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much, Kyle, for sharing your story. It's important work, and you must sleep well at night knowing the good work you guys are doing over there.
Well, we have lots of support and partners, and it allows us to do our important work better than we could on our own.
And that's acfb.org.
That's right.
Good stuff. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, got Chris Seabrook with Country Financial. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Lee. Thanks.
So, Chris, you like that segment? You learned something?
I did. I did. I've actually done some work with the Community Feed Bank, so it's good to hear a little bit more about the inner workings.
So tell us about Country Financial. How are you serving folks?
So I'm actually a financial representative, but Country Financial has been around since 1925. We were started by a group of farmers who wanted to kind of get together and provide products and services that would meet their needs and actually develop more relational business interactions. And since then, of course, we've expanded out to be able to offer products and services to individuals that aren't farmers. And we basically help individuals by providing financial security products in the areas of auto, home, life and business insurance, as well as investments in retirement planning.
Now, part of what you do a lot of research around financial topics, economic topics.
Correct.
And then you recently did one about the financial security index. I guess there's a food security index that Kyle was talking about, and you have a financial security index. And you learned some interesting things. You mind sharing some of that insight?
Sure. So Country Financial provides what we call our Country Financial Security Index. And what we do is we come up with different topics that are we think are kind of key to helping you build financial security, because country's goal is to be the number one provider of financial security. And this time we've worked on sharing economy.
And what's the share? What does that mean?
So the sharing economy essentially is platforms and resources that allow individuals to do things like ride sharing or streaming services, where you have an opportunity to experience different luxuries without having to take on all the expense on your own.
So now, do you do this in terms of, now this is how a lot of people are making a living, they're working in that economy, so they don't have like a traditional 9-to-5 job. Now a lot of people, you know, I'm driving for Lyft, I'm driving for Uber, I'm doing Uber Eats on the side, I'm, you know, Instacarting. Like, that's how I'm cobbling together my income, which makes me, I guess in some ways, I feel more secure because I have a lot of options. But historically, that's been a less secure way of making a living.
It kind of depends. So some individuals will use it as their full-time source of income. And like you said, it could provide, you know, a sense of security or a sense of control, because you have the ability to choose when you want to work and where you want to work and how you want to work. But a lot of people are actually using these opportunities as an avenue to provide additional income in their home. So it's not their 9-to-5, but it's
paying for Christmas presents.
Exactly.
Sanjay calls it her side hustle.
There you go.
So that's some people are using it that way. Do you know the ratio of, or are more people dependent on this as their day-to-day living, or is it more people are just using it kind of to make another couple $100?
So I don't have the official statistic for which way people lean. I think it just kind of depends on what market you're in.
Mm-hmm. So now in this sharing economy, now you as a financial advisor, there's some challenges there, right? Because their income isn't stable.
It depends. So again, it's highly contingent on how they're using these. So one of the things that we would actually tell them to do is make sure that you engage your financial professional when you're getting involved in these activities. One, you want to research to know what from an insurance standpoint how you're protected, and what resources are available from the platforms that you use. Because the nuances in how you're protected will change over time.
Mm-hmm.
And different insurance companies can sometimes look at these different at each different platform differently. So you want to know how your carrier is actually understanding each platform, so that you know how you're covered and when your coverage starts and stops.
So, like, if I have a house and then maybe my kid just left for college and now I got a room and I'm going to rent it out. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that I have to tell my insurance people, like, there might be different rules by having somebody come in and out of the house?
Absolutely. That's a great thing to think of now with the Super Bowl coming up, and you
that's
may
right.
want to make
a lot
some
of
extra money. Right. So, you know, there are definitely things that you want to think about, especially like the safety concerns with bringing someone into your home that you don't know.
Right.
But there's also financial risk that you want to take into consideration, like damage to your property, or even if someone were to be injured on your property. So, again, that's where you want to kind of engage your insurance professional to make sure that you understand how your coverages work and that you're kind of ahead of the game just in case something does happen.
So now when you're working with a client, are you're kind of part of their team of people that advise them? Like, are you this quarterback of the team? Are you the one that's saying, hey, you know what, pay attention to the insurance here. Hey, I know you want to retire, so keep this in mind. Like what's your role in a family's kind of financial situation?
Right. So I like the idea of being the quarterback. You know, of course, there are going to be a bunch of professionals that you'll want to have a part of your team. You're going to want to have a good attorney. You're going to want to have a CPA. You're going to want to have a good financial services professional. And, you know, there may be some other individuals that you want to add into that mix. You know, ideally, whoever you choose to be that head person, that quarterback who's steering your team, you just want to make sure that person has your best interest at heart.
So now, if I am considering doing this and getting involved in the sharing economy, like, what are call you up and I say, hey, I'm thinking of doing this. Like, how are you going to counsel me?
So, again, it'll depend on what platform you're looking at. But if we looked at something like a ride sharing, we want to take a deep dive and look at what your coverages, how your coverages are going to work, and how your coverages work with the carrier and as well with the platform. Because those could be very different.
Mm-hmm.
You also want to look at your deductibles, how you're covered for liability. And you want to know, you know, again, when the coverages start and stop, whether you're on or off the clock, and if those coverages will change at all at any point in the process.
Now, are you recommending, like, say I'm close to retirement age and I'm short. Is this something that you say, you know what, this is, you may want to stop working your full-time job, but you may want to do this. Is this part of kind of someone's retirement plan as well?
So I wouldn't necessarily go that way, that far. You want to go definitely into the specifics for that particular individual. You know, maybe it might be a good supplemental portion of their retirement income. So not necessarily stopping their current job to do this full time, but maybe it's a way to supplement income or just a way to get out of the house. But it'll really be determined based on their personal goals and their plans.
Now, do you have clients that are doing this or are involved in the sharing economy?
I do.
What's the most someone's made? You know, don't name their names unless they're in the room. Then we're going to name their names.
So we don't necessarily go into the specifics.
But is it something you can make $1 million, $100,000, or $50,000?
I would say, the better way to look at it, because there's so many different, again, intricacies when it comes to it. We don't necessarily break down the specifics of what they're making that way. What we do is we actually want them to look at a budget. So if you go through and you kind of pinpoint what your objective is, if your goal is to make $100,000, what we want to know is what's going to get you there. So how much are you making on average per hour? How many hours is that going to require you to work? And then we can kind of draw out that line as to whether or not you can make that million or whether or not you can make that 100,000 or so.
So you think it can be a part of somebody's kind of financial portfolio?
Absolutely.
And there's ways to make it work.
Absolutely.
So you're good with the sharing economy.
I'm good with it.
So, but it's here to stay, right? This isn't a fad that's going away, is it?
Oh yeah. I actually talked about it with my wife. Even now, you know, probably a few years ago, we would look at Uber and Lyft as this kind of mysterious new way to be able to commute from place to place without using a taxi. And now you've got ride sharing scooters. So, there are so many different things that are popping up here now that this is something I believe is kind of here to stay.
Yeah, I'm seeing it's even getting more robust in some ways. I know a person that does start out rideshare, and they live in South Florida, and they're like, hey, how come there's not rideshare for seniors that help them with more when they have more needs? And then it adds you have one concept
twist,
and now they put their own spin on it, and now you got something a little different.
Right.
So there's more of this to come.
Absolutely.
Well, so what's your perfect client look like? Are they young, old? Like, who's the right client for Chris?
So I work with a mix of individuals, but my personally perfect client is generally a family, normally in the range of about $70,000, homeowners, multiple cars in the household, and they're looking to build.
They're looking to grow.
Exactly.
And then how do you find these people?
At
the food bank while you're volunteering?
You go and you volunteer at the food bank, and the people who are helping out are
just they're good people, right?
Absolutely. It's a mix of networking, have an opportunity to come on shows like yours and share what Country Financial does, and just other activities that I get involved in the community.
Now, when you were growing up, did you think you'd be in this line of work?
I didn't. For a little while, I actually thought I wanted to be in retail management. I did that for about 3 years and realized that wasn't where I wanted to be.
And then how did you transition over?
So I have a degree in management and finance, my undergrad degree from the it was North Georgia College and State University. Now it's the University of North Georgia. And I wanted to go into something that actually used my education and ended up meeting somebody who was in the industry and kind of told me about how the profession could work for me. And I took a dive and have been in it now for 7 years.
So what's the most rewarding part of the job?
I think the most rewarding part of the job is actually being able to sit down with people and seeing them have that aha moment, whether it's where we're looking at their protections and they finally get it and it makes sense, or where we're sitting out and we're developing a financial plan and they're getting, okay, this is where I want to go, and I now see that I have a path to get there.
Well, if somebody wanted to learn more and have more substantive conversation with you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
You can get a hold of me in several ways. So my website is actually ChristopherSeabrook.com. You can email me at Christopher.Seabrook@CountryFinancial.com. And my office number is 770-392-0722. And my wonderful assistant, Carrie, is there holding down the fort.
And then at countryfinancial.com, you can see that this report that we were talking about and lots of other ones, right?
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Chris, for sharing your story today.
Thanks, Lee.
Hang with us. Got one more guest. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, I got the GM of Del Fresco's Double Eagle Steakhouse, Mr. J.D. Manning. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having us.
So, J.D., tell us about Del Fresco's. How are you changing the steak world?
Well, Del Fresco's Double Eagle is an ultra-premium steakhouse.
Ultra-premium.
Ultra-premium.
So there's premium.
Yes, there is premium.
And then there's ultra-premium.
And then there's ultra-premium, which is one step up.
So what makes something ultra-premium?
It's just the elevated experience that we provide, the guest obsession in everything that we do.
So tell us about that. How does that? Well, first of all, were you always in the ultra-premium world, or did you start maybe in the premium world or the regular world?
I started in the subpar world.
In the subpar world.
At
so
eight,
you really
Yeah, at 8 years old. At 8 years old, assisting the family in a snack bar that we owned.
So you owned a snack. So you've been in food service for a while.
Quite some time.
So you're in that world, and did you ever dream of an ultra-premium world?
Actually, I did. The restaurant industry is something that I've always wanted to be a part of since I can remember.
So now, at that snack bar, what was your role?
My role was to run and get anything that my father and uncle asked me to get.
Okay. So you were you involved in any of the creative decisions of...
Just how to wipe the tables down and get another person seated.
All right. So at some point, you moved up?
Yes.
To running your own show somewhere?
Yes, indeed. I moved up to being a general manager at another brand, then to being a director of operations and had a region of five states.
Was it in the steak world?
No, it was not. It was in a polished casual.
Mm-hmm. So now, is the steak world a different world?
The steak world is a different world. There's many competitors. To differentiate ourselves from those other competitors, we've created the elevated level of service, the personalized level of service, and we supply that in a beautiful, beautiful restaurant.
Now, Del Fresco's, they have a regular brand, or is Double Eagle is a subset of the regular Del Fresco's brand?
Yes, we are the Double Eagle in Dunwoody. We also have a Del Fresco's Grill that's in Buckhead.
And that's a totally separate concept?
Totally separate.
And is that a steak place as well?
It is also a polished brand.
Mm-hmm.
But the Double Eagle, what we do with steak is pretty incredible.
So are you, when you decide to go ultra premium, are you kind of just blank sheet of paper, just saying, okay, well, because you're defining it, right? You're deciding what this means in the industry?
Well, the brand decided what it meant in the industry, and it's the elevation of the level of service, the personalized service, the building, and what the building provides to you as a part of the experience. We have an expansive, award-winning wine list that speaks for itself.
So now, as a customer, I come in. What am I going to notice?
When you come in through the valet entrance, you'll walk up a wine tunnel. We actually have a wine tunnel that houses 2,200 bottles of wine, everything from Petrus, Harlan, Opus One. And when you enter the building, you're greeted by our host staff, and we take you into our dining room. The building was designed by Johnson Studio, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful building. We have an architectural oddity in our floating wine wall. We have a floating wine wall that actually houses another 2,500 bottles of wine.
So I'm going to notice that right away.
You will notice it right away.
And then I look around. What's it going to smell like? Am I going to smell just wonderful steak smells?
You will smell wonderful. We can end it right there. You will smell wonderful. But you'll also see that we have three bars. We have a main floor bar, we have an upstairs bar, and we have a patio bar that services our 120-seat patio.
So drinking's important. That's an important component of an ultra-premium steakhouse.
Yes, it enhances the flavors.
But I'm coming there for the food.
Yes.
Right?
And the wine.
So I'm coming for the food and the wine? Are they equal?
No, the food stands out on its own.
Okay.
The wine is exceptional, especially for those who enjoy vino.
So now the steak, though, is this a different kind of steak? Are you preparing it differently? All right, you're going to bring on your chef. Yeah. You brought with you the executive chef.
I always like him to talk about the food portion because this is his expertise.
Thank you, JD. I appreciate it. So how we prepare the steak, it is prepared different. We have broilers in the back of the house that we prepare all our steaks on from our vast variety of dried selections, you know, dried ribeye, dried strip.
So this is Matt Townley. You're the executive chef. Have you been in the steak business a long time?
I've been with Del Frisco's Double Eagle Steakhouse for about 6 years. Started in North Carolina, went to Denver, worked at three different stores in Texas. And, in that process, done multiple openings, new store openings, and just moved here in Atlanta back in July. So
this is the first Atlanta Double Eagle.
Yes.
And then, but your background has always been, you're a steak nerd, like you just love steak.
No, I like that. No, I wish I could say that. My very first restaurant job was working my way through culinary school, working at a barbecue restaurant.
At JD's Snack Bar?
At JD's, I started there, yes.
I hired him.
He did.
Good hire. Good that he's been with you a while. So now you get into the steak business. So what do you, like, you have opinions about steak, your own kind of vision about how to make a good steak, or is this kind of the Double Eagle way?
It is the Double Eagle way.
So you didn't have kind of a creative say in this?
Even if I did, I feel like I would kind of get shut down. It is our way at the Double Eagle, absolutely. But no, the way we do things at the Double Eagle is the right way, absolutely.
Okay, so what's the right way to make a steak?
Salt and pepper.
That's
it? And a hot grill.
Hot grill.
Yep.
Now, is it right on the flame or is it in a cast iron skillet? Like, how are you preparing it?
We use broilers in the back of the house, so it is a huge broiler. The heat comes from up above. And it's not coming from underneath like your normal,
right,
you know, grill.
So what's the advantage of up above heat?
It lets really the fat content soak down through the steak as opposed to it dripping off, into the grill and kind of losing it.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll finish it if we need to get a good sear on top of the broiler to get a nice caramelization and a char on the steak.
And then, what about the types of meat you use?
We offer a vast amount we offer our 8-ounce filet, our 12-ounce filet, ribeyes, strips, bone-in ribeyes, bone-in strips, bone-in filet, our porterhouse to kind of the best of both worlds.
Is it all beef?
It is all beef. We offer a vast amount of seafood as well, chicken, but we are a steakhouse.
Mm-hmm. And then do you have any kind of signature, weird, strange steak that like a ginormous that
we offer a 32 ounce long bone. We offer
a long bone.
Yes.
So what's a long bone mean?
So long bone is basically the rib bone attached to the ribeye. So you get a 32 ounce with big bone.
How big is the big bone?
It's pretty big.
Like a foot?
Yeah.
Bigger than a foot?
I'd say about a foot.
A foot.
Yes.
There's a foot long bone.
So you have this dinosaur bone on your table and
a Fred Flintstone.
Exactly. Yes.
Signed bone.
Exactly. We also offer a 32-ounce dry aged ribeye. It's a double bone-in, one of our signature steaks. The server takes it up to the table, carves it tableside. It's kind of all about the experience with that steak.
And that's usually for the table?
Yes.
So
yes.
The table orders that.
Mm-hmm. JD gets it for family meal.
That's. And how has this for you, JD? How have all these kind of delivery services impacted your business? You guys just say we don't participate in that?
Well, yeah, we don't participate in it. We want you to come in.
This is an experience in store.
In store, yes. We do offer to go. We do have takeout.
Because sometimes there's leftovers.
Where?
No leftovers allowed.
No leftovers.
So you don't participate in any of those? Because some of the restaurants do that as part of their business, but that's a choice you guys decided.
No, when I was saying to go, we do offer takeout orders.
Oh, so I can order it and bring it home.
Yes, and we do package up anything that you have left over to take with you.
Now, does that work? Can you eat steak the next day?
Absolutely.
So you have what's the secret to reheating steak?
I would say cook it over the stove.
And then should I order it rarer than I normally would if I know I'm not going to eat it all?
I want you to order it how you would like to cook it. Of course, you know, you heating it up the next day is going to affect the temperature a little bit, but.
Now, what about if I'm making steak at home? You have any tips for the home steak maker?
Again, salt and pepper and a hot stove. I like to cook at home. If I'm going to cook a steak, I like to cook it on a cast iron. I don't like to grill it, honestly. That's my opinion.
What about sous vide?
Sous vide, I mean, it's a great process. Sous vide really kind of means to cook at a constant temperature for a long period of time. We offer a sous vide bacon au poivre in-house that is, I believe it's our second highest selling appetizer now.
And then, so what's in that?
Sous vide bacon up. We sous vide it for 24 hours. From there, we broil it to get a nice caramelization and a color on it. We top it with a bourbon molasses glaze and pickled Fresno chilies.
And then, for you as a chef, what's your favorite part of the job?
Eating. Honestly, no. I love everything I do at the steakhouse. You know, the look on somebody's face after, you know, making them a meal. To my, you know, amazing back of the house staff, the amazing front of the house staff. All around, it's, you know, it's a wonderful job.
Now, how do you build a good team? Like, you're not from here, so how'd you build your Atlanta team?
JD and I actually spent 7 weeks together in a very small conference room at a hotel trying to get our hiring office together. And so we spent a lot of time, and, you know, we had a lot of time to hire an amazing staff.
Now, how do you find, when you're not from a market, how do you kind of plug into the right servers and the right you know, people to attract the right talent to your team?
I feel like, you know, you hire one amazing one and then you get five more that kind of come from that. But we spend a lot of time on Indeed, you know, really trying to meet the right people and learn the right names.
Now, how do you kind of make the culture kind of flourish inside of a new restaurant?
Well, the culture is really ignited by the leadership in the restaurant. It's us walking
the talk.
Aren't
you to the leadership?
Yeah, it's walking the talk.
Right.
If we are a very caring brand, a very caring culture, and that in itself keeps people in position, and they remain a part of the family for extended periods of time because of the way that they're treated. We do things like family meal before every meal period, where chef creates something new and exciting every day for the family before we go into to service, taking care of the guest.
So then your staff have tasted all the food so they can answer all the questions intelligently?
Yes, we do a taste plate every single day, twice a day, where we taste many of the same items every single day to make sure that they're perfect and that we've practiced and practiced and practiced until it's an involuntary function of making wonderful food.
Now, what about the are you leveraging some of the local farmers here?
Yes, we actually are using produce companies that are that supply to the local produce vendors. As far as our steaks, chef will speak to the steaks.
Our steaks, we got our steaks, most of them from stockyards out of Chicago. And then we do locally source out of Holpern's, which is actually located here in Atlanta.
Right.
Our dried selection, along with bone marrow, different options like that, along with fish as well.
Now, are you aging the steaks at your restaurant or they're...
No, we get them in pre-aged.
And then you're preparing them. How much steak do you guys go through? You're pretty new, right? How long have you been open?
A little bit over a month.
A month now, so it's brand new.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you learning about the Atlanta foodie community?
Really all around. I mean, they like the normal steaks that everybody does. Nothing really stands out. You don't have
to put peaches on things?
No peaches, no.
Now, I saw you at Afternoon in the Country.
Yes.
That's an event that's been going around in Atlanta for quite some time. Where a lot of the top restaurants and chefs appear,
mm-hmm.
and that supports a charity that's important to the Atlanta community called La Dame de Escoffier that provides scholarships to females in the culinary arts. What made you guys attend that event?
We wanted to get out there, get our name out there, you know, really kind of stand out because we are newer, and to let people know that we are in town and we are the Double Eagle.
And then how was that event for you guys?
It was amazing. It was a great turnout. You know, one of our appetizers, that we cooked. You know, we did the sous vide bacon au poivre. We did a smoked cheddar whipped potatoes. We topped it with a bourbon molasses glaze and Brunoise Fresno chilies.
Now, when you're going to an event like that, how do you decide what to prepare?
It's a little bit easier to prepare something easy for 1,500 people than it is to cook a steak for 1,500 people.
Sure.
So we wanted to get something, of course, off our menu out there so people are able to have the same exact thing. But
and then, JD, are you who's in charge of the wine? Is that you? It sounds like you look like a wine guy.
I do enjoy a good glass of vino. I can't deny that. We have a brilliant wine director. His name is Adam Pacillo. He is in charge of the wine. He's actually an advanced somm. We also have another advanced somm, June Lim, as well. So to my understanding, there are three advanced somms working in restaurants in Atlanta, and we have two working at the Del Frisco's Double Eagle.
And then, and that's part of the ultra premium experience, right?
The quality of the wine.
And then, so if you're a new to Del Frisco Double Eagle, what do you recommend? Take me through your ideal kind of meal there.
Well, the first thing I would do is just walk you around the restaurant and let you see what the restaurant has to offer.
To enjoy the architecture.
Yes, the architecture is phenomenal. Our service staff has been trained to be welcoming, to be obsessive in terms of taking care of the guest. Our menu is laid out so that you can easily identify the items that you want to purchase or that you want to experience during that dining experience. The server will walk you through. They'll actually walk you through the menu if that's what you choose to have done.
And then at the end, desserts, what are you guys known for desserts? You got to go.
We have a butter cake that no one leaves without trying.
That's a law.
It is law.
Double Eagle law.
And it wasn't a law created by me. It was a law created by raving fans.
The public spoke.
The public. When people come in, they say, my friend was here, and they told me I had to have the butter cake before I left.
Good stuff. So now, if I have a business meeting and I want kind of some privacy, is there an option for that?
We actually have three private dining rooms. We have a glass enclosed dining room that seats 60, which is a private dining facility. We also have a downstairs oak room, which seats approximately 60 people as well. And then we have a more intimate boardroom that seats 12 and has a 4-inch marble table. Each facility has its own TV, its own sound system, wireless microphones.
So I can do a meeting. If I need to do a meeting, I can use that.
You can do a meeting. You could do a buyout. You could take that $1 million that you saved
up
through investments.
All my Uber driving.
Yes, and
cash out.
And come in and do a buyout and enjoy yourself. We have a special events coordinator, Corinne Zaccalo, who is awesome at getting you everything that you need and setting your private dining function up.
So whether if I'm just going with my spouse or if I have a big meeting, you guys have room for me.
Yes. And we have a patio, once again, that seats 120, has its own outside bar, has its own speaker system. We can accommodate what you have.
And if somebody wanted to learn more, website for you guys?
Well, Del Frisco's Double Eagle. If you just Google Del Frisco's Double Eagle, it'll pop up. It'll take you right to the website. Our address is 236 Perimeter Center Parkway Northeast in Dunwoody. Phone number 770-274-0309.
And then best steak in town?
Best steak in town.
Yes, sir.
Good stuff. Well, thank you both so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Sanjay Touré. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.